Anna stood at the rail of HMS Inflexible in a group of the survivors from the lifeboats and watched the immense flat-topped mountain rise out of the Southern Ocean. From this distance, the proportions of the mountain were so perfect, the tableland at its summit so precisely cut, and the steep slope so artfully fashioned, that it might have been sculptured by a divine Michelangelo. The men around her were excited and voluble, hanging on the rail and pointing out the familiar features of the land as their swift approach made each apparent. This was a homecoming of which most of them had many times despaired, and their relief and joy were pathetically childlike. Anna shared none of it with them. The sight of land induced in her only a corrosive impatience that she knew she could not long abide. The drive of the great ship under her was too puny, too snail-like for her anticipation. Every minute spent out here upon the ocean was wasted, for it delayed the moment when she could set out on the quests which had, in a few short days, become the central driving force of her existence. She fretted while the drama of sea and elements unfolded before her, while the wind which had crossed the wide sweep of the Atlantic free and unfettered met the sudden constraint of the great mountain, and like a wild horse feeling the bit for the first time, reared and struggled in monstrous peak. Before Anna's eyes a dense white cloud blossomed upon the broad flat summit of the mountain, and began to boil over the sheer lip in a slow, gelatinous tide down the stark cliffs. And when the men around her exclaimed with wonder, she had only an insufferable desire to feel the land beneath her feet and to turn those feet back into the north to begin the search. Now the angry wind racing down the cliffs came again to the sea and ripped the placid sweet blue first to sombre gunmetal and then to foam-flecked fury. As the Inflexible came out of the lee of the mountain into the narrow roadway between Table Harbour and Robben Island, the southeaster struck her like a mallet, and even she was forced to make obeisance and heel to the power of the wind. In the days of sail, many great ships had come this close to the mountain only to be blown out again with rigging in disarray, not to sight land again for days or even weeks, but Inflexible, once she had acknowledged its force, drove in through the concrete breakwater, and surrendered only to the attentions of the fussy little steam tugs which bustled out to meet her. Like a lover, she kissed the wharf, and the crowd that lined it waved up at the decks, the women struggling with rebellious skirts, and the men clutching their hats to their heads, the strains of the marine band on the cruiser's foredeck rising and falling as the wind squalls gave Rule Britannia an unusual cadence. As soon as the gangways were lowered, a group of figures hurried up them, harbour officials and naval officers in tropical whites and gold braid, together with a few obviously important civilians. Now, despite herself, Anna felt a slight prickle of interest as she studied the white buildings of the town that were scattered along the foot of the high grey cliffs.
"Africa," she murmured. "So what was all the fuss about? I wonder what Santin—"
At the thought of the girl, all else was banished from her mind. Although she still stared towards the shore, she saw nothing and heard nothing, until a light touch on her shoulder pulled her back to the present. One of the ship's midshipmen, callow as a schoolboy even in his smart tropical whites, saluted her diffidently.
"There is a visitor for you in the wardroom, ma'am."
When it was obvious that Anna did not understand, he beckoned her to follow him. At the door of the wardroom, the midshipman stood aside and ushered her through. Anna stood in the entrance and glowered around her suspiciously, holding the carpet bag protectively in front of her hips. Visitors and officers were already doing full justice to the ship's store of gin and tonic, but the cruiser's flag lieutenant saw Anna.
"Ah, here we are. This is the woman."
And he drew one of the civilians from the group of men and led him to meet Anna. Anna looked him over carefully. He was a slim, boyish figure, dressed in a dove-grey three-piece suit of expensive material and superior cut.
"Mevrouw Stock?"
he asked, almost diffidently, and with surprise Anna realized that, far from being a boy, he was probably 20 years or so her senior. "Anna Stock?" he repeated. His hair had receded in deep bays on each side of the smooth, scholarly forehead, but had been allowed to grow feathery wisps down his neck and on to his shoulders. "We should take the scissors to you," she thought, and said, "Yeah, I am Anna Stock," and he replied in Afrikaans that she understood readily. "A pleasant meeting, aangename kennis. I am Colonel Gary Courtney, but I am saddened, as you must be, by the terrible loss we have experienced." For a few moments, Anna did not understand what he was talking about. Instead, she studied him more closely, and now she saw that his unbarbered hair had sprinkled on the shoulder of his expensive suit with flakes of white dandruff. There was a button missing from his waistcoat, and the thread dangled loosely. There was a grease spot on his silk cravat, and the toe of one of his boots was scuffed. "A bachelor," Anna decided. Despite his intelligent eyes and the sensitive, gentle mouth, there was something childlike and vulnerable about him, and Anna felt her maternal instincts stir. He stepped closer to her, and the clumsy movement reminded Anna of what General Courtney had told Santan and her, that Gary Courtney had lost one of his legs in a hunting accident when he was a boy. "Coming on top of the death in action of my only son," Garrick lowered his voice, and the look in his eyes was enough to soften Anna's reserves. "This new loss is almost too much to bear. I have not only lost my son, but my daughter and my grandson before even I had a chance to know them." Now at last Anna understood what he was talking about, and her face flushed with such fury that Gary recoiled instantly. "Never say that again!" She followed him as he retreated, thrusting her face so close to his that their noses almost touched. "Don't you dare ever to say that again!" "Madam," Gary faltered, "I'm sorry, I don't understand. Have I given you offence?" "Santan is not dead, and don't you ever dare again to speak as though she is. Do you understand?"
"You mean Michael's wife is alive?"
"Yes, Santan is alive. Of course she is alive."
"Where is she?"
Slow delight dawned in Gary's faded blue eyes. "That is what we have got to find out," Anna told him firmly. "We have got to find her again, you and I."